I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about a serious and somber subject, child sex trafficking. It often becomes a focus of attention when big events come to town, but it goes on all the time. We're going to talk about what we can do to protect our children. My guests are Tammy Silverman, President and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute, David Westenberger, CEO for the Indiana Youth Services Association, and Aubrey Lloyd, a trafficking survivor and advocate. Please join this important conversation. Call 866-476-3881, email nolimitswfyi.org, Facebook is No Limits WFYI, Twitter is WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking today about a serious and tragic subject, and that is child trafficking. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You also can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Tammy Silverman. She's the new president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute. David Westenberger. He is the CEO for the Indiana Youth Services Association. And joining us by phone is Aubrey Lloyd, a trafficking survivor and advocate. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Thanks. Good to be here.
It's good to have you here. Well, Aubrey, I'm gonna start with you because I think everyone, I think with these kinds of conversations, it's always good to try to ground it in the real and the individual and the specific. So if you wouldn't mind sharing your story with us, we would appreciate it. I'll try to interrupt only when I have a question or I don't understand something. Okay,
or
just
sure,
want to
no
make
problem.
Sure that we clarify.
So first, I can only tell the story for me, and although there's lots of similarities across the country, it's definitely not something that is kind of a one fits everyone as far as what trafficking looks like in the United States. So what I'd like to say is that there's push factors and there's pull factors when it comes to how does the child become exploited in our country. So some of the push factors for me that kind of pushed me out into the situation was I did have a lot of dysfunction at home. My mom, had some concerns with addiction. There's lots of instability in my home, witnesses to violence. And so that kind of didn't cause it, but it definitely made me more vulnerable to things later in my childhood. And when I was a teenager, I was really seeking attention like all teenagers do, wanting to kind of identify outside of my home, identify outside of the chaos. And a girl came into my after-school job, and she started a friendship with me. She was invested in me. I went and spent the night at her home. She came and picked me up from school. We spoke every day. We hung out every weekend. From kind of the outside looking in, it was like a regular, teenage high school friendship and relationship. She was somebody that was very important to me. I felt like she was probably the closest friend that I had up to that point. I let her know all my secrets, all the past abuses I had, all of the concerns that were going on currently in my home. And she decided one night, that it might be best for me to come and stay with her and her mom. And she encouraged me to run away. And at that time, I was only 16. And in my 16-year-old mind, that made a lot of sense for me to leave a place that was chaotic to go to a place that I perceived was going to be healthy and supportive. And so I did choose to run away that night. And that was kind of the pull factors that pulled me into the situation as someone that was investing time with me and built a relationship with me and someone that I thought I could trust. And so I left my chaotic home and went to my friend's house. And that night I was introduced to their escort service. The things that I had thought, was how their family functioned was completely different than how it was in reality. And I was asked to join, and I said that I did not want to. And they assured me that that was okay, and that if I had changed my mind, that there would be an opportunity for me to make money. They told me that an escort service is not about sex. It's not about prostitution. You simply just go out on dates with people. but I still didn't want anything to do with that. And again, they assured me that that was all right. That night, I ended up going with them out to a party with my friend after a party, and I was at a can of soda, and that can of soda was drugged. And so I was drugged, and I was literally sexually assaulted. When I kind of came to from my sexual assault, my pimp came into the room and said that was the last time that I would ever tell him no. And from that moment on, I was part of his escort service, and I no longer had an option in my mind to leave or to kind of do anything other than what I was told. And so I think sometimes we kind of look at the media and we think it's kind of what, how the movies perceive child sex trafficking, that a girl is, kidnapped from the side of the road and forced into this horrible situation. But what's more common is a story like mine where there's a relationship, there's an intention of recruitment. And for me, that happened, at an after-school job. And for others, it happens through a relationship at school or even a relationship that's, formed at church. A lot of kids are recruited offline in social media, forums. And so that was kind of my reality. And it wasn't in a third world country. It was in the state of Colorado, in a very, suburban setting. And men and young men, old men, rich men, powerful men, men that were doctors and lawyers and, kids that were involved in collegiate athletics. Athletic programs were the ones that were purchasing me, and many of them knew that I was young. A lot of them actually asked for me to appear or to act or even to state that I was younger than I was, which was 16. So again, it's not something that happens, in these other places or even just in the big cities. It's really happening everywhere and in every context. And we have very young kids that are involved in the very adult, very traumatic situations. And we're very unsure how to get out of there. Some people think because I wasn't chained somewhere that I should have ran when I had opportunities. But I was so scared. I had no idea, one, what I missed to, trust someone to end up in the situation that I was. So I didn't trust myself anymore. And then who was I going to trust to be able to help me get out of this? There were lots of adults, lots of very important people that were around the situation. And so they all seemed that what was going on was okay. So who could I trust? There were times when we'd be pulled over by the police and the police would let us go. There were times when I was taken to the emergency room after another sexual assault. No one asked any questions. No one kind of dug any deeper of why I was there. And so I really lost the concept that anyone really wanted to help me, or if they could help me, would they really be able to help me? So that's why a lot of the work that we know they're going to be talking about today with the Indiana Youth Services Association is so important, because we're really learning about how to identify these kids that are involved in this.
And
I was involved. Go ahead.
I was just going to ask, how long did this go on, Aubrey?
So for me, and I have to say that I was actually fairly lucky because I was only involved in this for a year. And again, that's a year of many sexual assaults. I witnessed tons of violence, physical violence, tons of manipulation. Just witnessed all of the dark sides of the reality of our world. But I was only in there for a year. I advocate and work alongside other survivors that were involved in this for 5, 10, 15, 20 years. But I was in there for about a year, and I was able to escape. And that's kind of when the real hardship started for me, because you get out of this reality and people think, okay, you're rescued, you're out of it, you're good. And then all of the trauma comes up. And at the time, we weren't talking about human trafficking when I was rescued. There wasn't conversations about trauma-informed care and what type of therapy can help, kids involved in this. And so I was really, listed as a sexual deviant at the time because I had engaged in prostitution. I was not seen as a victim. And so I was then kind of re-victimized by the system because they didn't know how to be able to help me. And so I spent many years, trying to figure out how to heal all of these things that I felt like, wasn't all my fault and I felt that I needed help with. But there was lots of judgment and lots of stigma attached to those things.
How old are you now, Aubrey?
So I'm 36 now.
Okay, so this happened 20 years ago, and I can just tell from talking to you, some of these experiences are still very, very fresh in your mind.
Absolutely, and they're always going to be. And I think, you know, some people think that, you know, trauma goes away after time, and I'm definitely in a better place and doing healthy things in my life. But it's a very dark reality that I'll never be able to fully get over, and it's just a part of who I am. I still have a scar. The wound is healed, but I still have that scar.
I want to ask Tammy and David, I mean, so that, because obviously I think every parent who is listening to this right now is terrified.
Absolutely.
So I'd like to, you know, the individual story, and there is a natural, I think, reaction of your parent to say, this could not happen to my kid. This could not. To reassure yourself. But it does. Could you put in perspective how large a problem is this? I mean, how many children are involved? How many lives are we seeing? It sounds like you've made it past this at some degree, or made I'm struggling for the terms here, Aubrey, made your peace with it, or at least learned how to embrace it as part of your life's experience and move on from it. But I can't get around saying how many people have had their lives damaged by something like this. Tammy, I'll start with you, but I want to hear David's
Well, and I'll
too.
Let David talk about, because they're really the ones that are doing the direct service component of this throughout the state. So I'll turn that over to him. But before that, I just want to thank Aubrey again.
Yes.
Because
yes.
The reality is, for us to know that this does happen and that it can happen in our communities with our children, it takes voices just like hers. And it takes tremendous courage to continue to say that and to work in this field. So we thank her. We know that hopefully by sharing her story, we've been able to raise awareness throughout the state. So thank you, Aubrey, for doing that.
David, how large a problem is this?
Well, unfortunately, the answer to that is we don't know yet. We know from last year in 2015 from the National Human Trafficking Resource Center, there were 53 identified cases of child sex trafficking in Indiana. We began our work in roughly early January of 2016, and we have served 128 kids since that time in 13 counties across the state. So this is not an urban problem. This is urban, rural. There are no parts of the state where this does not exist. It is everywhere. In planning for our work in 2017 and 2018, we estimate that we will serve 500 kids a year in each of those years and may still only be scratching the surface.
Well, that's where I was going to go with this, because if you're looking into this, you get some sense. Like, I know when I talk to prosecutors and police officers who investigate sex crimes and all of that, they tell you we are seeing maybe a tenth is being reported of what's really going on out there. What does your gut tell you, David, about how many numbers, what the numbers are really now?
I really can't take a guess at that.
There's a lot more, though, than you are seeing.
There definitely are more than we are seeing. What the ceiling might be, I couldn't guess on that. Now, the good news is it's not as significant a problem as some of the other issues facing young people. As far as numbers, there's much more abuse and neglect and food insecurity and other problems for kids across the state that have much higher numbers. Some maybe aren't as serious as this issue, but if I had to venture a guess, I would guess 3,000 or so kids are affected by this, but that's a guess.
Yeah, Tammy.
Well, and I would just add that according to the Centers for Disease Control, this is likely one of the most, if not the highest, underreported incidents of child abuse. And I think to what Aubrey was talking about, that's one of the things that we want to really make clear. This is child abuse. Mm-hmm. This is not something where it's you need to blame the victim or point to circumstances where they should have or could have or taken different actions. The reality is there are adults that are exploiting children in the sex trade. And so it's child abuse, and we know that it is grossly underreported.
And the reasons it's underreported, I would guess, but I'd like you to elaborate a little bit, is it's one of those subjects that makes almost everyone uncomfortable to talk about. A lot of it, and that's part of the reason that Aubrey sharing her story is so valuable, is it does sort of force us to confront what is an uncomfortable truth. Tammy?
and with individuals that, as she said, you might not expect to be involved. You know, for in her circumstance, and I think it's not unusual, the individuals that she went to thinking that would help her or give her stability seemed normal, if you will, from the outset, or seemed stable. But in reality, that was the pull into this type of abuse. And so I think that that's also something that's really important for us to have awareness about, is that it's not, you can't stereotype who's going to be involved in this.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about child trafficking, child sex trafficking on No Limits today. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking about a somber subject today, child trafficking, particularly child sex trafficking. If you would like to join this important conversation or would like to share your story or ask questions, we would love to hear from you. The best way to reach out to us, best ways to reach out to us, call us at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Tammy Silverman, the new president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute, David Westenberger, who is the CEO for the Indiana Youth Services Association, and joining us by phone and sharing her story with us, it's Aubrey Lloyd, who is a trafficking survivor and advocate. Aubrey, we sort of left your story so I could paint a picture that this is not an isolated circumstance, that there are a lot of young people, unfortunately, who are forced to deal with this situation. But we left without knowing exactly how you did manage to get out. Could you talk a little bit about what your escape path was?
Yes. So at the time, the way the escort service was being ran is that we were kind of, and there was a group of us girls, and we were kind of taken to different house parties and different apartment parties and different hotels, and there would be these just big gatherings of people. And so some of the parties had started being kind of tipped off to the police, and some of them had been raided. So there was a large conversation kind of with everyone that was involved, that, you know, someone was talking to the police, and just kind of lots of additional stress and chaos surrounding this. And so this circuit was also connected with gangs and drugs, which, you know, is very common, especially in some of the larger city areas, to have a gang connection with sex trafficking. And so in this particular case, one of the drug dealers, you know, I just have to say that he was just an angel put in a very unusual and unexpected situation, because he actually gave me an option to be able to leave that night. And so I had a regular client that was coming to pick me up, and I literally got in the car and freaked out and kind of told him that I needed to get out of there. And he allowed me, you know, he took me to my grandmother's house, dropped me off a few blocks away, and that was kind of, you know, my way out. It was, you know, kind of very unusual in lots of different circumstances, but I really just believe that in my situation, you know, God touched someone that was unexpected, and he gave me just a sliver of an opportunity to get out of there, and so I did. And then when I got out, though, again, like I had mentioned before, that was kind of the start of my troubles. My family was, one, very ashamed. They kind of didn't know how to articulate what I had gone through. You know, when your kid runs away or gets into trouble, you never think that this would be the world that they run into. And so they weren't sure how to kind of deal with everything that I was going through. So I ended up having to go into a mental health institution for a while because they just thought I was crazy and I needed someone, you know, to kind of help stabilize me. And then shortly after that, I just kind of figured out that no one was really going to be able to accept and understand what I had gone through. So I was just going to stop talking about it. Which is very troubling when you have that kind of high level of trauma. And then a few years after that, my sister was actually recruited by another pimp It was actually put into sex trafficking as well, and she was actually taken all across our country. She was exploited in Colorado, in Texas, Louisiana, and then we ended up finding her in Portland. When she was first taken, she was only 15, and she was gone for a little over a year and a half. And when we found her, she was very addicted to drugs. She was emaciated just from not having regular food, not having regular stuff to drink, being overly supplied by drugs, which is all very common. And at 16, she chose to end her life. Oh. And so her suicide is really what kind of put me into the realm of, I have to do something about this. I have to get myself healthy. I have to do whatever I need to do to be in a better place for myself, because this can't be the end of our story. There was two sisters from the same family. And so for the folks that think that it can happen to anyone. You know, I had already known that this was a possibility in our family, and it happened again. So there's importance that you have to talk about this. You have to become educated about this. You have to be able to give lifelines to your children to be able to, if they venture into this world, of how they're going to be able to get out. And as a community, we have to be able to respond to, you know, to kids like us that have been through this, because if not, the consequences are very dire, and suicide is something that is very common for girls and for women that are involved in the prostitution trade, because there's so much shame, there's so much guilt, there's so much physical and emotional trauma. If we're not giving them access of how to be able to help heal and how to, you know, show that there is a different way and a different journey in their life, this can very well be a possibility for lots of young folks. And so that's kind of why I'm so dedicated to this personal issue.
Let me, Aubrey, and I'm going to ask some questions here.
Sure.
I'm going to trust you. If I ask anything that pushes you beyond your comfort level or anything like that, that you will tell me that, okay?
And absolutely, that you will not a problem.
Okay. I want to ask about what it felt like when you came back. You'd already been victimized in a horrible way. And it sounds like at least part of the message you were hearing from your family and the older, you know, the authority figures around you is, you weren't the victim, you were the problem.
Right.
How did that make you feel at that?
Well, I mean, part of the problem is that my pimp had already kind of started the brainwashing that it was my fault, that it was my choice, that I was a bad person, that I was a bad girl, that I was stupid, that I was, you know, all of the unsavory words that you would call someone involved in this. And so, you know, so part of me had believed that. And then when I, you know, was able to escape and had started, you know, really wanting to heal and just try to figure out what all this mess was inside of me. And then I have experts and then I have family telling me the same thing. All of a sudden that just gave 100% of credence that my pimp was right, that all the horrible things he said to me, it wasn't a lie. It was all true. And I would have stayed very much stuck in that depression and very much stuck in just that really dark side of the world if my sister had not died. Her death is what catapulted me into a different place. And, you know, so we, you know, we have to be able to, you know, again, give kids different outlets and different options where death isn't what's going to cause people to have a wake-up call like I did. But it was very dark and isolated, and I just felt like the world was a very bleak place, and I wasn't quite sure how much longer I had wanted to, you know, to live in it myself.
What would have, if you can take yourself back to that time, what kinds of things, you know, if you had been confronted with your parent or your grandparent or some authority figure, actually would have been helpful to hear, would have been healing?
Well, I mean, yeah, the biggest thing that would have been helpful is just to acknowledge that what I was saying was true, that, you know, however hard or, you know, I mean, and again, no one wants to talk about this. Like you said, it makes everyone uncomfortable. But the reality that this thing is happening to kids in our own neighborhoods is frightening. And, you know, people have to kind of, you know, push back that fear and say, I believe you. You know, just like with kids that, you know, were sexually abused or abused in general, one of the biggest issues is to not, to not be believed. And so the belief would have been huge for someone to say, you know, what can I do for you? You know, how can I be able to help you? A lot of my healing in relationships came when I actually married my husband. And he's been able to do lots of those very things of saying, I do believe in you, and this was not your fault, and you made, you know, you were a child in a very adult situation, and, you know, you don't have fault in these things. And that you are worthy and you are loved and you are beautiful and you are capable of so much more. Those are things that I, you know, were invested into my life as I was growing older, but they would have been huge for me to hear when I was a teenager.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about child sex trafficking on No Limits today. If you would like to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named Kathy has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Kathy, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Don.
Certainly. What's on your mind?
Don, I am a sex and trauma therapist in private practice, and I am loving this show. And I wanted to hear the panelists' perspectives on the decriminalization of prostitution as a part of the solution to solving the trafficking problem. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay. Thank you very much for the call and the question.
Thank you.
Certainly. Well, I want to hear everyone's thoughts on that. It's a good question. I'll start with David.
There's been a lot of discussion in the public policy area of this issue, and it first thought, it seems logical to decriminalize this for what would be the victim in this case. One school of thought is, and there's been no resolution as what's the best path for this, but one thought, school of thought is by decriminalizing the victim, it becomes easier and the victims, potential victims, become more attractive to perpetrators because they know those people cannot be charged with a crime. So if you are recruiting someone to do something for you that is criminal and you know that they have immunity from that, it almost incentivizes recruiting people who are immune from those charges.
Tammy is shaking her head. I can tell there's disagreement there.
Well, I agree.
And I've spent
agree.
Enough time around the law, I can see a counter argument to that, too.
Sure. Yeah. Well, and I agree. I agree with David that there is discussion on that. At the same time, just because you're not charging the child involved doesn't mean you cannot hold the perpetrator accountable and charge them. And I think that particularly the way that we've talked about it today, is one of our big goals in talking about this very difficult subject is to categorize it as child abuse and to understand that these kids didn't have an option and don't mm-hmm. have an option and don't see a way out, and to educate folks on what some of those warning signs. So as Aubrey talked about, if the police do stop them and they see an unrelated child, or what are those warning signs, and to start increasing our awareness and our ability to screen for when a child might be in this circumstance.
Is some of it, yeah, go ahead, David, please.
We only, just some perspective, only since July 1 of this year in Indiana has trafficking been designated as a form of child abuse, as a CHIN 6 designation in the Department of Child Services. So that's what we're up against, a system that's not even, until July 1, prepared to even categorize this and begin to deal with it. We're still in the process of developing protocol and treatment plans. So it's really a tough issue when you don't even have social services, at least Department of Child Services, not their fault. We just didn't have statutes that allowed them to even categorize this as a form of child abuse.
Aubrey, I really want to hear your thoughts on this one. having experience, I really would like to know what you think about.
Sure. And this is a big issue, actually, in the survivor world. I know Amnesty International recently kind of, you know, wanted to promote, you know, the whole decriminalization. And there's different countries that kind of have pros and cons and, you know, lots of research and lots of kind of back and forth. From a survivor's perspective, I think that although I understand some of the mindset of wanting to protect sex workers, that if we, you know, decriminalize it, we're going to allow people to not have as much shame, that if something happens, they're more likely to go to law enforcement, there's more regulations involved. The concern with all of those things for me as a survivor is I have connected with hundreds, if not thousands, of survivors across the country and across the globe, and none of them have wanted to be involved in prostitution. There's something very innate that happens when you give that intimate piece of you away. None of it feels good, and there's trauma that's attached to every single time that we are sexually assaulted. And so whether you make that criminal or you make that you know, you take that, you know, that piece of it away, that trauma is still going to be connected to us. And I think when you decriminalize this issue, from my perspective, what we kind of do is give credence to the larger issue, which is how society already sees prostitution and sex. That there are people that feel that it's okay to pay for someone, and you know, we shouldn't be able to purchase people. You know, we say in this country that we got rid of slavery a long time ago, and in fact, it still exists. We should not have the desire to want to pay for people to do whatever we want them to do, to lose that free will aspect into it. And so I think that when we start having these conversations about decriminalizing it, and although, again, I do hear the aspects of how it can protect the sex worker, I think it just allows that kind of larger, you know, mindset that it's okay for me to do this, it's okay for me to desire this, it's okay for me to purchase people. It just, you know, gives gasoline to that already very distorted and dysfunctional way of thinking. And it puts more people in danger and more people at risk. And again, the trauma, even from people that were over the age of 18 that were engaged in prostitution, still had trauma, still had significant PTSD from what happened, because there's just a part of us that are not supposed to be bought and that are not supposed to be sold. And so I do not agree with that concept.
Should we consider, though, shifting the focus of the criminal penalties, making the greatest punishment fall not on the people who, you know, and I understand it's not willingly done, selling sex, but instead on those who are purchasing it?
That's the Swedish model.
Yes.
The Swedish model is what, you know, that definitely does that, is that it's not illegal to sell sex, but it's illegal to purchase sex. And that really, you know, has found to be effective in the Swedish model and in different places in Europe. I think that engages a more interesting conversation of why do we have this demand and how do we connect to this demand and how to, calm those numbers down versus just focusing on the victim and on the girl or the boy that's being sold, but of, you know, why there's that demand and that reason to get involved in the first place. I personally think that model is more successful.
I'd like to hear David and Tammy's thoughts on that as well.
Well, we have in Indiana increased the penalties. Mm-hmm. For the recruiters, the traffickers, the pimps, as Aubrey calls them, and also for the purchasers. So that has happened. I think there's still a lot of discussion about the criminalization as far as the victims. You know, as Aubrey said, it is wrong. And when you take that away from the victim, you take away some of that sense of it being wrong if it's not an act that's criminal in their mind because we've decriminalized it. So. But we have done a better job of increasing penalties for the perpetrator.
Tammy.
And I think that's a longstanding, you know, I think that's a longstanding question, not only with child sex trafficking, but with many forms of abuse. You know, we've been working for years on shifting the focus from why doesn't she leave to why is he doing this? And I think that that's the Swedish model that we're talking about shifts that focus to why is there demand? Why is our culture allowing this? Why are we legally saying it's okay? What can we do to make that not something that is acceptable in our community?
Are there other ways? I mean, there's a part of me, and I realize I should be detached and dispassionate about it as a professional trained journalist, but I listen to Aubrey talk, and I'm thinking, okay, this is a young woman who's already been through hell. The fact that she comes out of that and she's the one who has to carry the weight and not any of the people who abused her just strikes me as fundamentally wrong. Tammy.
Exactly. And I think that's what we were talking about, not only with the criminal justice system, but throughout our system, is if we learn about this and we educate, hopefully those teachers, those counselors, those coaches and parents will all be saying, how can we help you? You should not have had to endure this.
If you are just joining us, we are having an important conversation about a serious subject, child sex trafficking. If you would like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. My guests are Tammy Silverman, she's the new president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute, David Westenberger, who is the CEO for the Indiana Youth Services Association, and bravely and compellingly sharing her story with us is Aubrey Lloyd, a trafficking survivor and advocate. I'm John Krall. Please stay with us.
It's 39 minutes past 1 o'clock. You're listening to No Limits on 90.1 WFYI and WFYI.org, made possible by your sustaining membership and by the Indianapolis Arts Center's End of Summer Party Under the Stars, Art Sparkle, on Friday, August 19th, featuring music, live art demos, and a silent auction to benefit the Art Center. Tickets at indplsartcenter.org. Sign up for No Limits email topic alerts at wfyi.org/No Limits.
NPR election coverage sounds different. Yes, you'll hear stump speeches and breaking news, but you'll also hear stories you might not expect.
A politically active Latina Republican says he's not only supporting Donald Trump, but raising money for him.
States with the highest levels of inequality have been backing Hillary Clinton, not Sanders.
Many immigrants are trying to become citizens so they can vote against Trump.
Listen every day.
On 90.1 WFYI for your information.
Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism and publisher of the State House File, as well as your host. We are talking about child sex trafficking today on No Limits. My guests are Tammy Silverman, the new president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute, David Westenberger, who is the CEO for the Indiana Youth Services Association, and Aubrey Lloyd, who is a trafficking survivor and advocate. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimitswfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named Kathy has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Kathy, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
I was wondering if Tammy, David, and Aubrey could address the issue of, say, world-class sporting events, and how these sporting events can or cannot, I'm really not sure how it works, increase the amount of child sex trafficking at the site of the sporting event?
Good question. Thank you very much for the call, Kathy, and the question.
Thank you.
And I should say we've done, when, you know, Indianapolis hosted the Super Bowl, we had Greg Zeller on talking about just this issue that we see rises when there are major events like that. Tammy, you're nodding your head, so I'm going to go with you on this one.
Well, yes, I think that's when, for many of us in this area, that this, you know, this issue came to high relief. The fact that this could happen and that it was associated with these events that so many of us look forward to and celebrate, that there's kind of this dark side to it. And I think that also goes to what we were talking about before as far as, talking about this can't be a part of our culture, and it shouldn't be part of the Super Bowl. It shouldn't be part of any other great events, and it shouldn't be part of daily life. Just as Aubrey said, hers wasn't, it wasn't connected to this major event, but it was also something that if there is a demand for it, if there is a culture for it, that's problematic. And there are going to be, unfortunately, people that exploit that demand by creating supply. And I think that it's really that issue of societal demand.
There are a lot of questions I could ask just about the larger subject, but I think I would be remiss, and a lot of parents probably are waiting for me to ask this question, good folks who are concerned. What are some of the signs we could see that a young person is being pulled into this world, not necessarily just with our own children, but you see some young person out there and, you know, who might be in trouble and that you do want to try to help if you can. I'll start with David on that one.
Some of the indicators, just that we know nationally, the risk factors for young people to be involved in trafficking. And trafficking has many forms, not just sex trafficking, labor trafficking. Runaway and homeless youth and addiction. That you know, just like Aubrey's story, deciding or home is not a good place for a young person, and at that age you're not equipped maybe all the time to know where a good place is to go, or certainly have not thought through your future other than tonight, and end up in a situation that ultimately becomes unsafe and unhealthy. And, you know, a lot of the runaway and homeless work that we're all involved in. We know what that leads to, addiction and really just survival mode for kids. And it makes them vulnerable and susceptible to people who are out there to victimize, take advantage, and make a profit from these kids.
Aubrey, you look at this with different and more knowing eyes than most of us. What signs do you look for?
Well, I think one is you have to really understand who's around your kids. We really need to know who are they hanging out with at school, after school. I've worked with girls that were exploited and in a church youth group, someone that seemed lonely and that, kind of in need of a relationship, and someone really kind of attached themselves to that person. I've worked with girls that were exploited by just someone coming after school and asking if they needed a ride home. So it's really wanting to know who's around your kids, and sometimes it really looks like a really intense relationship. And when you're looking at teenagers, everything kind of seems intense. So it's being able to have those conversations, engaging. There were girls that I know that were exploited at home. They went home and they would go to school and be sold. You running away doesn't always necessarily mean there's something different. But from my perspective, what had happened to me, I was given lots of things. I had lots of, higher end clothing, and, my nails were going, we were getting done, hair getting done. I had access to money that I couldn't have afforded on my own. I had access to things that I wasn't able to have on my own. I know lots of pimps during their kind of their grooming stages will, give girls brand new, cell phones and, start giving them lots of gifts. And so kind of starting to question, where are these gifts coming from? The biggest thing is kind of the withdrawal aspect. I was isolated from everyone in my family, my friends that I had. All my time and attention kind of was devoted to this one relationship. And so paying attention to what's happening with your kids and who are they spending all their time with, and wanting to get to know who those people are. Pimps and recruiters don't have time to have a relationship with you as well. And they don't want parents that are nosy and parents that are asking questions and parents that are involved in those types of things, because there's too much of a likelihood of getting caught. So they're going to go on to the next person. So for me, it's, kind of looking at, are new things coming into the house? Is your kid around new things? Are they starting to withdraw, and to never, ever think it's just a typical high school teenage thing? They're just moody for no reason, or they're just going through that regular teenage experience. But to really ask questions and to really get involved with who's there. Because for me and a lot of the other people that I do advocacy work alongside, there was a relationship that was known that no one second-guessed, no one questioned, and that led them into some very dangerous situations.
We've gotten a question from a listener named Maria on Facebook that deals with the decriminalization issue that we talked about before. With Maria's permission, I'd kind of like to refocus it a little bit. We talked about the question why, and maybe we should shift some of the penalties. Are there ways we could change the system or change the legal code so that we do more to empower victims, to create better avenues for them to escape? Because I think the most horrifying thing about Aubrey's story to me, well, I shouldn't say that. All of it is horrifying to me, is that her escape at some level depended upon the kindness of a client, the kindness of a stranger. Absent that sort of random act, God knows what would have happened to her. Are there ways that we could change legal code so that we make it easier for people who are trapped in this situation to get out? David, you're looking thoughtful, so I'm going to start with you.
I think about some of my conversations with Aubrey around this. From our perspective, they're in a bad situation, but there are so many analogies to DV. The first being, if you get out, where do you go?
DV, you mean domestic
violence.
Yeah.
It's just not, sorry.
That's okay. It's just, my job is to break down the acronyms for
it's
us.
It's just not that simple. Yeah. And... It, it, For for people like us, this is a horrible situation. But you know, we often hear people say that while they're being victimized, overall their situation may not be as bad as it once was. So there's just tons of competing factors, and from the information I've gotten in conversations is I don't think the criminalization is the issue that's keeping people, victims, from getting out. There's the trauma bonding. There's all the other things that go on that are far greater and have far more influence than whether or not there are legal consequences at the end of the day for this. I just don't think that's at the top of the mind for the victims.
Tammy.
Well, and again, I would agree with David that, you know, parallel or similar to the domestic violence movement, I think as you tend to focus on how can we help these victims, what can we do for the victims, how do we create the statewide networks, how do we create the systems, how do we do those things that will help them, that the criminal justice system and the policies and all that will come along with it. And I think as we continue to start, you know, we need to start with how do we help these kids? And what do we do? And I think back to your question about indicators, I know the U.S. Department of Education has recognized the fact that this is going on and that teachers are often, you know, they spend so much time with our kids. So they have created a list of indicators for what teachers look for. And when we were looking at that, obviously that works for parents too, some of which seem normal, unexcused absences, you know, bruises or signs of trauma. But one of the ones that in this situation is that when asked about those, you know, a lot of teens, when you ask them about why didn't you do this or why were you absent, they kind of fumble around their words. They look down. They, you know, they don't know what to say. In cases where the child is being trafficked, sometimes, many times, they seem to have rehearsed answers because they've perhaps been coached or conditioned to have those responses ready at hand. So I think, again, I agree with David that, you know, our primary and initial focus is on how do we help the victims? How do we create the systems to do that? And the other things will come along with it.
We are talking about child trafficking, particularly child sex trafficking, here on No Limits. If you would like to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Ian has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Ian, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, and thank you.
Certainly.
I have a unique situation. I'm active military, so a lot of soldiers, before they go abroad on certain assignments, we get a three-hour brief on how to identify trafficking, because you can go to do something simple as go out to a bar just to have a drink, and you are financing trafficking because the young lady that's the bartender is you, the one being trafficking, where, especially outside the United States, they hold these young ladies' passports and they have to work it off, but they were promised from their homeland that they would have a nice job and et cetera. But they end up working in clubs, and that's where the sex trafficking comes in. Oh, they're trying to sell you extra drinks because they can get extra things, personal hygiene items, and things of this nature. But we are educated thoroughly on how to not participate with the trafficking. But as a safety personnel and having to investigate, because my primary job was to go into different clubs to ensure that the fire exits are not locked, because they lock the exits so the girls can't get out. And it puts our soldiers in jeopardy. But finding out more how it really works through the black market and things of this nature is kind of startling from my standpoint as a father, as a grandfather, to understand that, you know, people are doing things with these young ladies that are unspeakable. They wouldn't do with their spouse or personal friend or what have you. And so I look at it from the standpoint, like you said, slavery, abuse, and things of this that goes on, and how they kind of keep them as prisoners, and they only let them out to do work, and they put them back away, and they feed them and what have you. But here in the States, I've noticed, like you say, large events such as racing and athletic events where they come out. You know, there's a saying, what happens when you're away stays that way. You know, too many people take advantage, and I think that's where education comes in when we start dealing with young adolescents to educate them on what's really going on out in society, because you can easily slide into doing something and not realize what you're doing. And then, like, from the woman's standpoint, they try to get their friendships and doing things for them and doing things. And, you know, it's a lot – I hate to say this, but a lot of things that go on out here where – once they get that confidence in your friendship, you're lured into things and you're not even aware of what's going on. And it's very hard to get out.
And Ian, I want to jump in because I do want to hear the panel's thoughts. You've raised a lot of really important thoughts, and we've got very little time left. So I want to try to get their thoughts on what I think is your main theme, which is how we can educate the public more about this issue and those signs. Thank you very much, though, for bringing this to our attention. Take care. I'm going to start with Tammy on that one.
Well, and Ian's absolutely right. You know, I was encouraged to hear that the military is doing those kind of briefings. And I think, again, that's system building. And that's something that around this issue that we're talking about is how do we make sure that anybody, the parents, the teachers, the counselors, law enforcement officers, how do we have those systems where we all know what some of those signs may be and how can we respond to those? And I think that even though it's that system building's new to Indiana, we're already seeing the positive impacts of helping those victims and helping those kids.
What are the positive impacts, David, that we're seeing?
Well, just the increase in number of victims we've identified and been able to serve. I think, and it's through a strategic effort that we've been involved with since January, and that is we've broken the state into 5 regions and have coordinators in each of those regions that are reaching out to social service agencies, schools, people that are engaged with youth to educate them on what the issue looks like, law enforcement, and it builds from there. Businesses, hotel and innkeepers groups, you know, you just have to saturate the public with education in every aspect that this occurs. Nail salons where, as Aubrey said, they send girls to get their nails done. You have to create awareness so they know what to look for because it's right under people's noses and they're not aware. So it's a long process. We're on a 3-year project right now, but we're educating in the area of 15,000 people a quarter on this issue, but we've got a long ways to go.
If there is a young person who is listening to this or following, the show on social media and is in one of these circumstances or situations, can we give them a number or a route or a URL or someplace they can go to find help? David or Tammy, either one of you. I want the help to come. I don't care where it comes from.
National Trafficking Victims Hotline. Okay. That's connected to the state. You can call. That's an easy number to find, and then they go directly to us and to whichever of our 5 regional coordinators or the same area that the person calls from.
I think Tammy's got the number.
It is. It's 1-888-373-7888. And so we also have that on our website.
To them again.
It is 1-888-373-7888, and it's available on either of our websites, I'm sure.
And the DCS hotline.
Okay. Aubrey, I think it's appropriate that you have the last word here. This one's just going to be purely selfish indulgence. In listening to you, I've come to care about you. Could you reassure me at least that your life is okay now and tell us about where you are?
Yeah, my life is more than okay. And the reason that I'm not there with you guys today in the studio is I just had my second son.
Oh, congratulations.
No, I'm doing really well. I'm able to do advocacy work all across our country, even been invited to Washington, D.C. I'm very excited to work alongside David and Tammy in doing this work here locally in Indiana. I'm married. I have 2 beautiful young boys. I have some very important relationships in my life. And so any of the folks that are out there that have been affected by this themselves or have family members that have been a part of this, life on the other side is very much a possibility for everyone. It's a long road, and there's lots of things that have to happen for us to be able to heal. But being able to acknowledge that we've been victimized, to be able to have, community members come around us and say, we want to help support you to get you to that next stage of life, all those things are very important. So all the stuff we talked about today is helping others, not live
in the
victim mentality.
And I'm sorry, Aubrey, I'm going to have to cut. We're running out of time. I'd like to thank all of my guests and our listeners. I'm John Kroll. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive media coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And board engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Cerzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations. We'll be right back.
Thank you.